time for I've Been Thinking, Alexia Russell. What's your IBT for me today?
Well, you'll find all about out about this in less than half an hour. Wallace says the details play today. And if you want to listen to it, this is what Ellie Moore had to did when she was laid off from Stuff. She this is the journalist who was all about the Me Too reporting era. She was the whole unit at Stuff.
She's
Me Too
on the
reporting.
Tomorrow.
Mm? Oh, great. Well, she could either go back to reporting and do sort of general stuff, or she could follow her passion and try to make a meaningful difference in this area. She's setting up a venture, which is a kind of a technological solution to trying to fight our most underreported, one of our most underreported crimes. Just 8% of sexual assault cases, abuse cases reported.
And 8%?
Yeah, and what she's trying to get off the ground with Zoe Lawton is quite spectacular, and she knows she's battling the, you know, the battle for the charity dollar is fierce in this economic downturn. But oh, maybe she'll tell you all about it tomorrow, and you can listen in to the details.
8%. I can imagine the reasons as to why that number's low. Do you want to elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah, there's a lot of barriers to it. Well, they don't think they'll be believed. Sometimes women don't know if what has been done to them is illegal. Embarrassment, obviously. The strength of this new app they're doing is that when women register for it, anonymously, of course, the software will search the database for a match, so you can build up a case like the Christchurch Mama Hooch case, where all sorts of victims came out of the woodwork. If you get a hit, because most of these sexual abusers, these predators, are serial sexual abusers, and so
it's a step forward, right? Yeah. Yep. Very good, Alexia. Thank you. Peter Dunn, I've been thinking.
Well, I've been thinking about the on-again, off-again threats to the after-hours emergency service at Kenepuru Hospital, just north of Wellington. This has been going on for years. I can remember in the late 1980s as the local MP campaigning to keep the after-hours service open. We succeeded at that time. And then next time there was a funding issue or a staffing issue, what's offered up for closure? I can remember when I was the Associate Minister of Health on at least two occasions having to make clear to the District Health Board that the government did not want that unit to close. Now it's being proposed for closure again. It's just ridiculous. Every time there's any sort of a funding or staffing crisis, it seems that the first thing that's offered up locally is after-hours emergency service at Kenepuru Hospital. And yet Kenepuru Hospital serves a base of population probably larger than Wellington Hospital serves. So I'm just frustrated and furious that yet again this campaign's on. I note that Barbara Edmonds, the current MP, is leading the charge to keep it open. I wish her luck to do so, but frankly, it's beyond a joke that it seems to be the first sort of thing offered up any time there's any suggestion of there being pressure on hospital budgets or services.
Do you think, Peter, it's one of those push-button things where people will get really upset, do something about it, and achievement unlocked?
Well, it certainly has been so far, but I think people will be getting just a little tired of every few years, here we go again. I mean, I've long suspected that the main reason it becomes an issue is that the doctors don't actually live anywhere near the area and don't like having to work late nights there, rather work in the city. So, but it's just not good enough. There's a big population base that's at risk, and the sooner they pull their heads on this and keep the service going, the better.
And you could imagine you are in an accident. You're in a quad bike accident, you are in a car accident, whatever.
That's right.
Look, and you need an after hours, and it's not available to you. How fearful
and it's the first,
would that
if
be?
If you're coming off Transmission Gully, if there's been an accident on there, for instance, as there has been tonight, it's just one exit off it. And to not have the after hours emergency service open is just foolish.
Very good. All right. Fantastic, both. Your Cure memories coming through. Oh, my God, I love The Cure. They were my high school years. I mean, The Cure meant so much, right, to so many people.
Oh, yeah.
Wallace, I recall when The Cure played Wellington way back in the 80s and asked the audience if it was okay to play some or all the set a second time, and then partied at a couple of local flats with Wellington musicians, imagining partying with Robert Smith of The Cure.
That must have been early on, because when they played up in Auckland, they played for 3 hours without repeating a song. That's how extensive their hit list is, and every song a hit.
Mega band. All right, very good. Peter Dunn, Alexia Russell with me now to this. Today, Labor has warned that allowing just three ministers having the last word on fast-tracking infrastructure projects opens them up to accusations of bias, not just this government, but any government, especially when political donations might muddy the waters. The aim of the fast-track bill, allowing major infrastructure projects to bypass lengthy resource consenting process. A one-stop shop infrastructure to get this country moving at last. With us, Max Rashbrook. He's from the School of Government, Victoria University. Kia ora, Max.
Kia ora, Wallace.
Concerns have been raised across spectrum. For example, National Party pollster David Farrer, he said, look, he worries that there are no safeguards to prevent bribery being used by the wealthy to get consents from whichever politicians are in charge of the beehive. You share that concern?
Yes, I do. I mean, you can divide opposition to the bill into two camps. I mean, one is the view that the bill is simply completely unworkable and it's such a massive departure from normal democratic processes that it should just be scrapped. The second view sort of says, well, you know, assuming that the government is going to go ahead with it, which looks likely, can we at the very least put in some safeguards around the decision-making processes? And, you know, and I think it's very significant that it's a National Party figure saying, well, at the very least, you know, everybody who applies for fast-track consent under this process should have to declare basically all the meaningful dealings that they might have had with any of the three decision-making ministers. At the very least, we can see if there are conflicts of interest and we can see how they're being handled.
I'll get the panel to jump straight in, Max, because I'll definitely have some questions and thoughts. Peter, you first.
Well, a comment, then a question. It seems to me this is Think Big Revisited. It's just like the National Development Act of the Muldoon government in the early 80s, and we all know what happened there. But, Max, I'm interested. You made some comments this morning, which I think are equally pertinent about the way in which this thing is panning out in terms of MMP government and the fact that we were supposed to be getting a more consultative and collaborative form of government, but we've now ended up potentially with first past the post plus in terms of the power of the majority to simply impose its will on Parliament and the country. And I'd just be interested in you just expanding on that.
I think that was Richard Shaw that
was
said
Richard
that too,
Shaw,
by the way.
Well, yeah. Well, I'm sure Max wouldn't disagree with that view, and I'd just be interested in teasing him out a little on it.
Yes, look, I mean, I think Richard's right on that. I mean, the comment I'd make, which is related, is that, you know, what we are seeing, I think, at the moment is a lot of, you know, sort of popular frustration with elite decision-making, and that's been well canvassed in some surveys recently. And what I think this, you know, this partly is people, is National and New Zealand First in particular, riding that wave and sort of saying, well, all those processes and rules and procedures, they're for the pen pushers and the bureaucrats. You know, we are the strong men and we're getting things done. And that certainly has Muldoonist overtones. It has very authoritarian overtones, I think.
You know, it worries me. You know, New Zealand used to be one of the least corrupt countries in the world, and it seems to me, you know, New Zealand First with its tobacco lobby ties and the gun lobby with Agnes Shane Jones and its fisheries mates, it seemed to me that this is the thin end of the wedge. New Zealand's so small, it would be so easy to be accused of corruption when it comes to these things. I mean, what safeguards are they? I mean, they're not telling us much, but do you think there'll be any safeguards to stop that, like you say, public declarations of interest?
Yes, I mean, at the moment in the legislation, you know, as it's written in the bill, there aren't any safeguards. Chris Bishop did say this morning on Morning Report that he was open to amendments to the bill, which is positive. But as it stands, there's really no way to manage the potential for corruption. Labor's already pointed out, you know, as you said, that there's a couple of companies that have donated, in at least one case, really quite large sums of money to the National Party, who are on the list of companies that have at least, you know, been told, here's how you could apply. So, yeah, so at the very least, I think we would need, you know, a list of all the
right
companies that have donated, the companies that have lobbied, all the potential conflicts of interest that those three ministers face, They need to set them out. They need to say how they would deal with them. And I think they would need to step aside, actually, which of course is very difficult when there's only three of them. But if there's a very severe conflict of interest, you can't just declare it, I don't think. I think you have to step aside from the decision.
Because David Farah came up with a possible solution to add on to that, I think. Max, here's one. So, for example, a condition of consent application should be applicants have to detail, at risk of criminal penalty, all dealings they have had with ministers, MP staff in the last, say, 10 years, and if there have been any donations by them or associated parties. That sounds pretty solid to me.
That would be a very good start, and again, significant that it's coming from someone in the National Party. But I would just repeat, though, it's not always enough to declare the conflict of interest and say, oh, well, this might be a conflict, but I'm going to carry on as normal. I think you actually have to step away from those decisions if you are too compromised. And it's very difficult. This is the thing about political donations. You know, if they've gone to an entire party, then potentially anyone in that party is compromised. I mean, if Simeon Brown and Chris Bishop have to make a decision on a project put forward by Winton, for instance, a company that has partly funded their electoral success as a government, how can they make that, you know, openly and with integrity? Yeah. I think that's a real dilemma.
Isn't there a fundamental question here? And that is the concept that three ministers taken to themselves the power to make decisions which override a whole range of other pieces of legislation and agreements that might have been reached. Isn't that also an issue we should be challenging? This is not a democratic environment where in the interest of progressing something, the decision-making is constricted to a very small number of people who have almost unlimited power.
Okay, I just want to come back on that. I want to say, Max, well, look at this. There have been parallels between the fast-track legislation and the National Development Act of 1979, which then Prime Minister Rob Muldoon used to push for the creation of the Clyde Dam. Look, we've got a dam, Max.
Yeah, and look, I mean, Peter's probably better qualified to speak to that than I am, but what I would say is that, you know, in a lot of senses, this legislation, this bill looks like the classic sledgehammer to crack a nut. I mean, yes, there does seem to be a broad consensus that it is taking too long to consent things. We're at one end of the pendulum there, but that doesn't mean we need to swing all the way to the other end with this very authoritarian legislation. There must surely be a halfway point where we speed things up, but there's rigour, there's expertise, it's not three ministers doing it. And I would also say, just final point, and limit it to a very, very small number of crucial, nationally significant projects. Because even if there is an argument that we were right to push ahead with the Clyde Dam, that surely cannot be true for hundreds of projects that could damage New Zealand's natural environment.
Max, good to have you here. Kia ora. That's Max Rashbrook there from the School of Government at Victoria University. 10 to 7, the panel. Big response here. Yeah, I was immensely grateful when Kenepuru was open about 12 years ago when I was electrocuted by a house current in Paramata in a flat accident. Saved my life. So, yep, wonderful responses today, and including perhaps more on this issue than any other. So a brief response to this. So US comedian Aj Barker, he was on Flight of the Conchords, was getting distracted by a crying baby. So he stops the show and asks the mother if she could take the baby outside. In a post, Danielle said, late on Saturday night, Aj Barker demanded my 7th-month-old cousin, who relies on her mum for milk, my mother and my auntie's friend, also a mum, to leave his show, claiming that he was ruining his train of thought. David, who was also there, said to the Sydney Morning Herald, the mother and child were sitting about four rows from the front and the baby was making a bit of noise, as babies do. Around the panel, it's 15-plus show. Was Aj Barker in the right to stop the show and tell mum and bubba to get out?
Absolutely, 100%. He's very funny, Aj Barker, by the way. He's quite hilarious. Look, when I was breastfeeding my son, I actually went to a netball match that I was providing commentary for the next day and sat at the back, and I did feed my son. but not at a, you know, not at a comedy club at night when I could have got a babysitter. It's so inappropriate.
But here's the deal.
If I'd started making sounds through your intro, Wallace, Wallace, would you have been put off? You're a professional. Are you not really, are you?
Oh, you see.
I'm
not even going to come to you.
Yeah, because you've been put off.
No, I haven't been put
off. Your train of thought's disappeared down a drain, isn't it?
Professional comedians. I can't speak. Are you going to keep doing that?
Yes. Peter, what do you think?
Well, I think there's time and place, and I just wonder about whether a comedy show was the right place for a mum and a young baby to be at in those circumstances. But it's not unusual. I can remember going to Billy Connolly concerts and hearing him shout out members of the audience who either made inappropriate interjections or who came in late. I've seen the same with Barry Humphreys in somewhat more humorous circumstances. But this sort of thing happens. But I think it's a question of whether it was just a bit of a lack of judgment on the part of the audience members being there at that time.
That is my point. Comedians aren't like radio hosts. They're supposed to deal with hecklers. If Arj can't deal,
you can't deal with
a little baby, then get a job in real estate.
Well, he's very funny.
Yeah,
and
obviously
I don't
not
think people should
can't
heckle comedians anyway. It's just rude.
Anyway, your thoughts, most welcome on that. I just think that it was really inappropriate that Arj actually told Mum and Bubba to actually leave the room. I mean, come on, we're having a nice time, a little whinge, you know, be professional, really.
I suppose 2-1-0-1. Bad the noise was, though, doesn't
it? Yeah, exactly.
I would have been really, really angry if I also had a nursing baby and I had taken the night off and handed that child over to somebody else and gone out, and then someone else's baby is ruining the night for me.
You're all on Arj's side, by the way. 100% right to chuck them out. They should never have been in the first place. 7 away from 7, the panel. We have Peter Dunn and Alexia Russell with me this evening. Now, will we get a national stadium on Auckland's waterfront? Maybe a 70,000 capacity sunken stadium, Bledisloe. Or a 55,000-seat facility, Wynyard Point. Or, hey, a roof over Eden Park. Auckland Council has a working group considering 4 options, and we should know by the end of this month. But are these rugby stadiums really worth it? Dr. Robert Hamlin from the University of Otago has weighed up the pros and cons, and is with us now. Dr. Hamlin, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me on.
It's a pleasure, and it's right to say that your fair city has arguably one of the best stadia in the country with a roof that closes over in bad weather. Surely you're proud of it. You've got to be for it.
Well, I think some people are. I always opposed it on really the fact that it was a rugby stadium, and as a result, because it was ratepayer funded, it's become a very substantial charge on the ratepayers of the town. I mean, it was touted as a multi-use stadium, but it's basically, its central arena is a natural grass surface, which is exactly the same size as a rugby pitch, under a transparent roof with 2 stands facing one another. And that essentially renders it at best compromised and at worst useless for almost any other purpose. It is not a particularly good concert venue for a variety of reasons, and because of the natural grass surface, it can't be used for things like exhibitions and trade fairs and things like that. And the Christchurch Stadium is unfortunately appears to be, despite the fact that it was touted as a multi-use stadium, it would appear to be another rugby stadium, which is going to be unfortunate for the ratepayers of that town.
Yeah, well, this issue, Robert, why we got you on, is really playing out in other cities. And, you know, Christchurch, of course, they're building their one. Auckland. Alexia, your thoughts, your comments?
We were talking about North Harbour Stadium before and how they want to tear it down. North Harbour has 250,000 residents. And I think the problem with the stadium is not that it's not well designed. It's that no effort has been put into over the years encouraging acts there or encouraging events there. And the 2 sport that kind of adopted it, the Tuatara has collapsed, and the New Zealand Football used to have a Auckland team that's based there, I think the Kings, and they collapsed as well.
So you're putting your hand up for North Harbour. Let's bring.
Why would they tear it? Why would they tear it down? It's not old.
Peter Dunn.
Well, I take Robert's point about multi-purpose use for stadia. In Wellington at Sky Stadium, I mean, I'm just thinking over the years I've been to rugby, I've been to football, I've been to cricket, I've been to Aussie Rules, I've been to an Elton John concert, the Rolling Stones concert, all in Sky Stadium. So that's a multi-purpose venue, and I think they work well in that environment. I do think there's a problem if they've only got one use, and I think sometimes this whole idea of national stadia in one place is a bit dangerous as well. So I think fit for purpose, multi-purpose, but probably just being much more flexible in their use than we have been.
So from your expertise, Robert, you're interested in there, but looking at what Tamaki Makaurau want to do or propose to do, a multi-billion dollar sunken stadium, 70,000. So we're talking big. What are your thoughts? Should we do it?
Well, I believe the working group is considering a number of alternatives, but certainly one of the main tools that is used by the backers of these stadiums is a thing called economic impact analysis, which is where you say that this structure will contribute $5 million this weekend to the economy. Now, there's two problems with that. One is that trying to get an economic impact analysis is a bit like trying to reconstitute the raspberries out of raspberry jam. It's almost impossible to separate the economic impact. So if you look at the Christchurch Stadium, where they're saying they're going to have business events, and they say, well, we've had 150 people come in, they've spent $1 million in the town. Mm-hmm. Well, you could say that's an economic impact of $1 million plus what's known as the multiplier, where is a concept where they can make that figure bigger. But you can also argue, well, actually, they would have come to Christchurch anyway, and they'd have just gone down to the convention centre down the road. So therefore, the actual economic impact of the stadium is actually the difference of it being there, which is nothing. So you have economic impact is almost a voodoo science where you can make up whatever you want. But the biggest problem when it comes to stadiums and economic impact analysis, and this has been the case with every economic impact that's been presented so far, and we'll go back to Christchurch Stadium, that they're looking at, they say, well, it will deliver an economic impact of $50 million a year, which in my opinion is optimistic, but let's just take it as a given.
Well, 30 seconds to go.
Yeah, okay. They don't factor in the cost of the stadium. So the cost goes out of the community as well. And when you factor that in, the economic impact is negative.
Got it. Dr. Hamlin, thank you very much for being with us. And thank you, Alexi Russell, Peter Dunn. Wonderful stuff. Happy birthday, Anna. Stick around. I'm with you till 8.
The softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.